Gildan Media, a division of Recorded Books, presents Choosing Courage, The Everyday Guide to Being Brave at Work by Jim DeTert. Narrated by Steve Manash. Publisher's note: this audiobook has bonus material. Please contact whomever you purchased this audiobook from to request the material. All figures referenced in this audiobook can be found in the bonus material. Preface: A Time for Courage. We are living in an extraordinary time. As I write this in October 2020, COVID-19 continues its global devastation of individual lives and entire communities. And protests about police brutality and systemic racial injustice are ongoing in cities across the United States and around the world. Amid this pain and despair, we're also witnessing acts of true courage, from healthcare providers speaking out about unsafe or unacceptable working conditions, retail clerks trying to enforce safety standards that those above them won't, or people of color demanding change in their organizations and beyond. Though current events make the need for courage more obvious than ever, I committed to writing this book more than a decade ago. Around 2008, I began ending my courses with students and professionals with a short wrap-up lecture. Then I said, "If we had more time, there are many more tools I could have shared to add to your toolkit. But here's the thing. In the end, I don't believe the range of one's toolkit is the primary differentiator between better and worse leadership. What I think matters much more is the courage to use those tools when needed." Then I'd give a few examples of workplace courage and share why I thought it was desperately needed for all of us to become examples for others. Not one student, then or since, said they worked in an environment where courageous behaviors weren't critical or that they always happened when they should. Aspire as we might, there are as of yet few, if any, truly fearless organizations. So I'd implore them to go out and make the world a better place, to do something courageous and report back so I could update my final speech with their stories. Here's what has consistently happened since. People write me weeks, months, and even years after hearing these remarks to ask for resources on the topic because they need help preparing for a difficult conversation, engaging with an issue they've been avoiding, or pursuing what they know is important but fraught with risk. That's why I've spent the last few years reading everything I could about courage, and courage in workplaces more specifically, and collecting my own data from thousands of people in different investigations of workplace courage. I didn't just want to add my voice to the cacophony of others just encouraging courage with no concrete roadmap or advice. I wanted to add something meaningful to the dialogue for those who know they should and would like to act more courageously. This book represents my attempt to distill everything I've learned into a research-based but highly accessible guide for those I've had the privilege of working with in person, and the many more I've yet to meet. I was truly inspired by the incredible stories I've been told, and I want to share them with others. Truth be told, I also needed these stories in a way I can only now articulate. I grew up in a relatively poor, single-parent family in a nondescript Midwestern city. I often felt impotent, knowing that my life wasn't what I wanted it to be, but unable as a kid to do much about it. Perhaps most depressingly, when I looked around for inspiration, it was often lacking. Adults, too, including those in positions of authority, seemed too often to be, to use Thoreau's words, living lives of quiet desperation, rather than competently and courageously charting a better future for themselves and others. All these years later, I'm still disheartened and angered by the lack of courageous action by leaders and non-leaders alike. I just can't stand the idea that we'd be so willing to give up our agency, authenticity, and moral calling for whatever it is we get in return. We all have fairly regular opportunities to act in courageous ways, to undertake actions that we or others perceive to be worthy or noble, despite the risks the behavior entails. Worker safety or working conditions certainly weren't perfect before COVID-19, and we were far from a world where people could expect the same treatment at work and elsewhere, regardless of their skin color, gender, or other demographic or identity characteristics. What's so unfortunate is that we've largely accepted the notion that courageous action is only to be expected from extraordinary people in extraordinary situations. This book presents a challenge to the idea that courage is the province and responsibility of the few. I'll share why I believe that courage, especially courageous acts done competently enough to create positive change, isn't innate. We don't believe that only some of us are born with the capacity to be virtuous in other ways, such as by being honest, fair, or prudent, or expect these kinds of behavior only once in a great while. So why would we expect that only some of us have the capacity for courageous action? My goals in writing this are to urge you to accept the need for courageous action as your responsibility too, and to understand that competent courage comes from the choices you can make to learn and repeatedly practice specific skills, just like competence in any domain does. And I want to help you more frequently choose to act during everyday opportunities to step up or speak out at work, rather than letting your fears hold you back. I also want to help you understand that courage isn't just about the spectacular, rare acts that make headlines or get one labeled Times Person of the Year. It's about all kinds of behaviors that are desperately needed in organizations if individuals and organizations are going to learn, be healthy, and thrive. If you want to do more to protect others at work, whether colleagues, subordinates, or customers, who are powerless and often ignored, taken advantage of, or discriminated against, this book is for you. If you want to do more to solve important problems at work, whether they be inefficiencies that waste time or money, internal processes that sap morale, or product or service choices that lead to dissatisfaction among current customers and inability to attract new ones, this book is for you. If you want to pursue opportunities more frequently, whether that means taking stretch assignments that might increase your impact and satisfaction, or pursuing work in a different organization that better fits your talents and values, this book is for you. Likewise, this book is for you if you want to be the person bold enough to lead your organization into new markets or new lines of business, or to make other decisions that allow your organization to better fulfill its mission. And if you want to get better at innovating, whether that be conducting and implementing small experiments in parts of an organization, developing and launching new products, or creating new processes that allow your organization to radically improve, this book is for you. We know that we desperately need more of these behaviors. When we don't step up to protect others, we allow continued abuse and discrimination toward our colleagues and harm to our customers. Think of Wells Fargo or Volkswagen. When we don't step up to solve problems or pursue opportunities, we contribute to the likelihood of organizational failures and the statistics showing that only about one-third of American employees are highly engaged at work. And when we don't have the courage to innovate, we increase the odds that we and our organizations will join the millions that have been leapfrogged by nimbler upstarts and those more prepared to thrive in a rapidly evolving digital world. Thus, the question isn't whether these everyday opportunities for courage are important. The question is whether you'll embrace more of them. But to be clear, this book is not a call to organizational martyrdom. I'm not encouraging everyone who reads it to be prepared to lose their job, their friends, or their health every time they spot a problem or an opportunity at work. It's not a call to shoot from the hip or make yourself vulnerable the second you have a strong emotion or an idea. Instead, I'm encouraging you to consider courageous action as something that can be done more or less competently, where competence means you increase the chances of actually accomplishing something positive and decrease the likelihood of negative personal consequences. The people whose stories I share throughout this book have chosen courage. Their accounts provide inspiration, but also clarify that competent courage is about perspiration. To choose competent courage is to accept not just the responsibility to act, but the obligation to learn and continuously practice the skills that increase your chance of creating positive outcomes for yourself and others. If you're ready to choose that path and be inspired along the way by the incredible people you'll meet, then this book is for you. Chapter 1. Choosing Courage. Stuart Scott will always be remembered as a trailblazer. As the first black anchor on SportsCenter, ESPN's flagship program, Scott's use of slang, his references to black music and culture, and his clever catchphrases helped ESPN appeal to younger viewers, especially younger black Americans. Scott's style was influential. African Americans throughout the history of this country have been told that we needed to conform, to assimilate, that we needed to be less street, be less hip-hop, be less hood, just be less. Recalled Michael Smith, a sports journalist and former ESPN commentator who grew up watching Scott on television. We had to be less of ourselves in order to make the majority feel comfortable. For Stuart to come along and be every bit as good and professional, as sharp, as polished as any broadcaster doing it, but yet still be able to be as authentic and connected and representative of the culture as he was, it was just incredible. Beyond his on-air brilliance, Scott fought a well-documented, multi-year battle against terminal cancer and became an inspiration to many beyond his sports viewers. Upon his death at age 49, he was universally praised by fans, colleagues, athletes, and journalists. In a written statement, President Barack Obama commended Scott for being a pioneer. Stuart Scott helped usher in a new way to talk about our favorite teams and the day's best plays. That's the part of Scott's story many of us know. Keith Olbermann, his longtime colleague, shared another part few people know. I cannot think of anybody I worked with in sports whose professional courage I have admired more, he said in a heartfelt tribute. Olbermann was referring to Scott's behind-the-scenes struggles at ESPN. Though he is praised today, Scott received strong pushback from some viewers, media critics, and an ESPN executive. He was told to stop using language that most of the audience, meaning white viewers, didn't understand, or he'd be taken off SportsCenter. It was awful, recalled his wife Susan. People don't really know how awful it was. Stuart was desperately frustrated. Scott's response to this pressure, said Olbermann, was the single most impressive thing I'd ever seen a television sportscaster do. Faced with two apparent choices, to back down and tone down his style to protect himself and his career, or to lash out, Scott decided on a more creative option. He defied the directive from above, but did so in a way that it made it nearly impossible for the executive to carry out his threat. Scott went on air and publicly congratulated ESPN on its willingness to accept crucial aspects of American culture that had traditionally not been adequately represented on TV. This brilliant, gutsy act neutralized the executive, who now had little choice but to let Scott carry on or be seen as explicitly against tolerance and respect for black culture. That, Keith Olbermann wants us all to remember, was a brilliant act of workplace courage. What is workplace courage? Throughout my career, I've heard hundreds of stories of people like Stuart Scott who've acted courageously at work. Take Chris, a medical student, who pushed a supervising psychiatrist to order a simple diagnostic test before sending a suicidal patient in the ER to the psych ward. Because of Chris's courage to challenge authority, the medical team discovered that the patient's unremitting pain was caused by a vascular disease, which was resolved with surgery. Or consider Jackie, who launched a marketing and sales campaign that her organization's president was against. "If you want to do this, your job is on the line," he told her. "If it works, you stay. If it doesn't, you can find something else to do." Jackie, after a few days of intense deliberation, decided to go for it. Though the campaign was a success, she's told it was the most successful one in the company's history, and she kept her job, she was never thanked for her work. Though these examples may not fit in the traditional view of courage, which historically has focused on physical acts, Stuart Scott's, Chris's, and Jackie's feats are surely courageous. Each faced a choice to act or not, and, despite the threat in all three cases of recrimination from their superiors, each chose to step up when most people wouldn't. In scholar speak, I define workplace courage as work domain relevant acts done for a worthy cause despite significant risks perceivable in the moment to the actor. But put more simply, workplace courage is taking action at work because it feels right and important to stand for a principle, a cause, or a group of others despite the potential for serious career, social, psychological, and even physical repercussions for doing so. Workplace courage comes in many forms. It is speaking truth to power and to peers, subordinates, and other stakeholders whose behavior is causing problems or falling short of what's possible. And it includes acts aimed at personal and organizational growth, such as taking on stretch assignments, owning bold initiatives, and innovating within or beyond one's current organization. You'll notice that these acts represent everyday opportunities for courage, the kinds of things we might hope we'd do routinely. When it comes to courage, we need not go looking for special occasions or wait for a single big moment. We need only to decide to act when the chances come, which they do for all of us. This runs counter to how many people view courage as a rare trait that's practiced only by exceptional people. In fact, thinking of it this way is counterproductive and an excuse for our own inaction. As educator and social activist Parker Palmer has written, if examples like Rosa Parks' unwillingness to move to the back of the bus in the 1950 South are going to inspire us to our own action, rather than merely be something we passively admire, we must see her as the ordinary person she is. That will be difficult to do because we have made her into a superwoman, and we have done it to protect ourselves. As Palmer correctly notes, we have to take her and others off the pedestals we've placed them on to avoid holding ourselves to the same standard of virtuous action when the opportunities arise. I've had the privilege of meeting some amazing people as I've studied workplace courage, and I can assure you that they range across gender, ethnicity, nationality, physical appearance, political orientation, religious commitment, education level, and so many other dimensions we use to categorize people. A few are rich or high status, but the vast majority are not. Unless we normalize acting courageously, seeing it as a possibility and responsibility for everyone, too many of us will keep waiting for others to do it, hiding uncomfortably behind assertions like, we can't all be Mandela or Gandhi, or that we're going to do it later when we have more power. You'll always have something to lose, and there's no credible evidence that says an abundance of courage in others is right around the corner to save us. If you want to make things better at work, for yourself and for others, the only thing you control with certainty is your own willingness to take action. As I'll detail in this book, courage is about skills that can be learned and developed. There are specific things you can do before, during, and even after a courageous act to increase the odds that the risk you take isn't for naught. And there are plenty of opportunities to practice everyday courage, building your courage muscle a little at a time by starting with relatively safer, more manageable acts from which you can learn. It's these skills, honed with practice, that differentiate those who act and act competently from the rest who don't. Why is courage in short supply? We know in the abstract that courage is valuable, even if we wish someone else would be the one to act. Winston Churchill said, courage was the first of human qualities because it guarantees all the rest. Writer C.S. Lewis, likewise, claimed courage wasn't merely a virtue, but the form of every virtue at the testing point, which means at the highest point of reality. The leadership literature is also rife with claims about courage as a virtue, attribute, trait, or behavior pattern needed for effective leadership. My own students certainly believe that courage differentiates those leaders who succeed from those who fail over the long run. Protecting and inspiring others, solving problems, pursuing opportunities, growing and innovating. Put that way, it seems clear that we should want and be motivated to be more courageous. So why aren't we? We're programmed to avoid unnecessary risks. Because humans have evolved to subconsciously prioritize perpetuating their genes, it's quite logical to worry about not doing grave harm to ourselves in all types of social settings. We've also spent most of our time as a species living in small groups or clans, and so making sacrifices for those not very closely related to us, such as risking one's family's well-being to do what is right for a large group of employees or citizens scattered around the globe, probably isn't instinctive for most of us. It's a conscious choice we have to make against these very primal instincts. Our instincts are often reinforced by vicarious learning. Sadly, we see too many cases of people getting ahead at work, at least in the short run, despite or even because of their lack of courage. While it may eventually catch up to you, there are certainly enough examples of getting ahead by going along for people to believe that courage might be for naive losers. When I asked a sample of my MBA students to think of someone highly successful in a leadership position over the course of an entire career, and then rate that leader on a set of characteristics, courage scored highest, higher than technical knowledge or skills, intelligence, and work ethic. But when I asked them to think of and rate another leader who has been highly successful in a leadership position for just a short period of time, courage rated last, with work ethic at the top. So, in the eyes of these ambitious young people, courage is clearly a hallmark of those who have had highly admirable careers. They don't, however, think it's as important as other things when one is getting started. The question, of course, is when courage will kick in for those who spend years rationalizing that it's just not time yet. In my experience, the answer is too often never. Our language has also evolved to remind us of the benefits of conformity and risks of challenging the status quo. Phrases like, be a team player, be loyal, don't rock the boat, don't risk your career over this, we've always done it this way, everybody does it, and let it go, are abundant. Whereas those pointing to the value of speaking up and persisting in change efforts are few in comparison, and suggest significant hardship. For example, fight tooth and nail, or stick to your guns. There is also the fact that, whether or not we are willing to admit it, most of us want to be liked. And given the intense pain that social rejection can bring, we certainly don't want to be disliked. Hence, it's natural to view life, and leadership in particular, as an extended popularity contest. Consciously or not, we avoid doing things that might anger or alienate the people whose approval we seek, so they'll continue to like and endorse us. If you doubt that, check out the behavior of posters on Twitter, Facebook, or any other social media platform. Beyond the instinctual and culturally reinforced basis for frequent conformity and conflict avoidance, it's undeniably true that courage is in short supply because it is inherently risky. People do sometimes see their promotion prospects vanish. Some do lose their jobs. And some do suffer broken relationships and deeply bruised egos as a result of courageous action at work. In most modern work organizations, there are plenty of risks. Even in places like the United States, where the First Amendment of the Constitution protects free speech, most employees with at-will contracts, and that's the vast majority these days, can't say what they want without potential repercussions. Want to publicly criticize political officials in the United States? Go for it. Want to criticize your organization's leaders? Tread carefully. Fortunately, many fewer of us face physical risks at work today than at any time in history. Though firefighters, police officers, oil rig workers, and miners, among others, still routinely put themselves in harm's way. And, to a surprising degree, so do those who deal with angry customers or former employees. Most of us do, however, face potential career risks. Despite all the talk about flatter organizations with more shared leadership, most people still have bosses and are still wage-dependent in one way or another. If we push the envelope too far, we could get fired, blackballed, held back, or otherwise negatively impacted financially. As William Derezowitz noted in his book, Excellent Sheep, People don't like it when you challenge the consensus because you're forcing them to question.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?